Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 21. I will call this chapter, Job Replies to Zophar. The wicked do indeed prosper. Our context is this. In our last chapter, Job chapter 20, Zophar has harangued Job and told Job that the wicked will suffer because there's a one-to-one correspondence between doing good and doing bad. And if you do bad, bad things happen to you. Therefore, if bad things are happening to you, therefore you are a sinner. And Job, bad things have happened to you, therefore you are an evil, rotten, miserable sinner. And Job puts up with this verbal abuse, and now he's going to turn his guns back on Zophar in this chapter and let Zophar hold it. So, chapter 20, Zophar speaks, the wicked will suffer. Chapter 21, Job replies to Zophar, the wicked do prosper. So do the wicked suffer, according to Zophar, or do they prosper? And Job is trying to say, look, wicked people prosper and good people suffer in this world. Well, we know who has the better of this argument. That's Job. So let's start now in Job 21, verses 1 through 3. Then Job answered, listen carefully to my speech and let this be your way of consolation. Job is talking to Zophar. Bear with me that I may speak. Then after I have spoken, you may mock. Now Job is answering, as I've just said, he's answering what Zophar said in the previous chapter, that the prosperity of the wicked is only for a short time, that they basically get judged, and therefore, Job, you're wicked, you're going to get judged too. Let's take an example of that in Job 20, verses 4 through 5, the previous chapter. This is Zophar speaking. He says this, do you know this from of old, from the establishment of man on earth, that the triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless momentary? So Zophar is trying to say the wicked always suffer on the earth. Now Job answers that and he says, I want you to listen carefully to my speech, Zophar, and let this be your way of consolation. What does it mean, let this be your way of consolation? There's four ways you can look at this, actually. John Gill gives us option number one, reading this in a straightforward way. You will be consoled by the truth of my words, Zophar and friends. You will find pleasure and comfort in what I say. I don't believe that because I can't imagine Job would think his words are going to comfort his tormentors in the least because he's getting ready to let them hold it. So I don't think that's correct. Here's option number two, also from John Gill. Job is saying that listening to Job would replace all the earlier so-called consolations that his friends had tried to give him. In other words, to be heard would be the best consolation Job could receive. So in verse 2, when Job says, listen carefully to my speech, let the fact that you are listening to me be your way of consoling me, because nobody's listening to me. Job has already called his three false friends miserable comforters, as the King James has it, sorry comforters, as the NASB has it, in Job 16:2, sorry comforters are you all. Well, listen to me so that you can console me. Well, that's option number 2. Here's option number 3. Let this be your way of, let's translate it differently, Adam Clark says, retraction. Let this, by listening carefully to my speech, Job says, let this be your way of retraction of all your arguments against me. Well, I don't know Hebrew, and I don't know if that's reasonable. I haven't seen that anywhere else. Let's look at option number 4. This is also from Adam Clark, who says that Job could be speaking sarcastically. Listen carefully to my speech. Let this be your way of consolation in quotation marks. You've comforted me. You've given me so-called consolation by dumping on me for 20-something chapters. Well, now I'm going to give you some comfort. And of course, this comfort is in quotation marks because it's not really comfort. It's really discomfort, blasting his opponents. So we read it this way. Listen carefully to my speech, Job says, and let this be your way of consolation. I'm going to console you with some hard words. Spoken sarcastically. I really don't know what Job meant. So I'll leave it there. Job says, bear with me that I may speak, that after I have spoken, you may mock. The NIV and the KJV has mock on. After I have spoken, you may mock on. I like that. Just keep it up. We go to Job 21, verses 4 through 7. Job says this, as for me, is my complaint to man? And why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be astonished, and put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am disturbed, and horror takes hold of my flesh. Why do the wicked still live, continue on, and also become very powerful? Now, this is a little strange. In verse 4, Job says, "As for me, is my complaint to man?" I'll take it straightforwardly there. As Gill and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown do, they say that Job's primary complaint was with God, not his friends. And so when Job says, "As for me, is my complaint to man?" that's a rhetorical question, asking for a no answer. My complaint is not to man, it's to God. I'm not really worried about you guys. I'm worried about God, why he's not giving me an answer here. Why shouldn't I be impatient? I've gone to God. He doesn't listen to me. As John Gill says, Job had poured out his complaint before God and had directed his prayer to the God of his life. He had desired to speak to none but the Almighty and to reason only with him. He had petitioned him to take cognizance of his case and to admit of a hearing of it before him and to have it determined by him. He had complained of wrongs and injuries done him and begged to be redressed and righted, but got no answer. And so Job is saying, I'm talking to God. Why shouldn't I be impatient? God should answer me on something like this. Adam Clark disagrees with that take. He says that Job's primary complaint was with his friends, not with God. So when Job says, as for me, is my complaint to man? That's a rhetorical question warning a yes answer. My complaint is to you, false friends. And so as Clark paraphrases Job, alas for me, is it not with a man that I speak, i.e. Zophar? Again, if this be the case, why should not my spirit be troubled? I do not reply against my Maker. I suffer much from God and man. Why then may I not have the privilege of complaining to creatures like myself? In other words, my complaint is to creatures. And I've got a right to complain to mere creatures. I might not have a right to complain to God, but I've got a right to complain to you, Zophar. So Clark takes it exactly the opposite of the way Gill and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown do. I'm not really sure what Job meant there. But I do understand why he should be impatient. It's interesting. The patience of Job, the endurance of Job is proverbial. And yet Job here says he is impatient. He wants to know what the answer is. Why is he suffering? Job says in verse 5, look at me and be astonished. As John Gill says, no lovely sight to behold, being covered with boils from head to foot, his flesh clothed with worms and clods of dust, his skin broken, yea, scarce any left. However, he was become a mere skeleton, reduced to skin and bone. And so he says, look at me and be astonished. Why should an innocent man look like I do? Put your hand over your mouth. Now, what did he mean by that? Well, it could be silent. Don't even talk. Or it could just be an expression of shock. Oh my gosh, we do that even in our culture. You can hardly believe what you see, so you put your hand over your mouth. So Job's condition is too astonishing for words. Or it could mean, put your hand over your mouth and don't keep telling me that innocent men don't suffer. I'm an innocent man and I'm suffering. I don't want to hear your words anymore. I think most probably it's just an expression of astonishment at how Job looks. Job says in verse 6, even when I remember, I am disturbed. Remember what? Well, John Gill suggests the iniquities of Job's youth. Nah, why would he be worried about the iniquities of his youth at this point? More likely, Job is saying, when I remember the happiness and prosperity that I had before, he's disturbed. Because he thinks about all that he's lost. That makes more sense to me. Or it could be, Job is saying, even when I remember all the cases of divine providence for evil people that Job is getting ready to relate, how God blesses evil people, and that disturbs him, because they should be punished, not rewarded. And he should be rewarded and not punished. So Job says, verse 6, horror takes hold of his flesh when he thinks about all of the good things he's lost, or of all the examples of evil people prospering. Verse 7, why do the wicked still live, continue on, also become very powerful? And of course, that's the main question that Job's answering. Why do the unrighteous prosper? It's a question that any human being sooner or later will ask himself. Now, when Job asked the question in verse 7, why do the wicked still live? He could be asking that to God, as John Gill suggests. How can God reconcile the prosperity of the wicked with God's righteousness? Or it could be that Job is asking the question of his friends, why? Why do the wicked still live, Zophar, you who keep saying that the wicked will automatically suffer horrible, untimely deaths, as you said in the last chapter? Why is it that that's not true? Why is it that the wicked still live? Well, whoever Job is talking to, he's right about this. Wicked people do prosper. And I don't see how Zophar, with a straight face, could make such a strong case that wicked people always get punished, because they don't. Not in Job's time, and not in our time. We go now to Job 21, verses 8 through 11. There. Now, who is that referring to? That's referring to the wicked. Verse 7, why do the wicked still live? And then verse 8, Job says, their descendants are established with them in their sight, and their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and the rod of God is not on them. His ox mates without fail, the wicked's ox mates without fail. His cow calves and does not abort. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. Verse 8, their descendants are established with the wicked. That's in opposition to Job's opponents. At least Job's sentiment here is in opposition to what Bildad and Eliphaz say, because Bildad says in Job 18:19, the wicked has no offspring or posterity among his people, nor any survivor where he sojourn. But Job says, oh yes, they do. The wicked have descendants that are established. The wicked can just look at their offspring and see in the wicked's sight all of the descendants they have. Their offsprings are right there before their eyes. So Job contradicts Bildad, speaking in Job 18:19, and in Job 5, verse 4, Eliphaz says this, his, the wicked's, sons are far from safety. They are even oppressed in the gate, and there is no deliverer. So Eliphaz says, see, the wicked, they get blasted. They never prosper. Job says, on the contrary, they have plenty of offspring. Verse 9, their houses are safe from fear. The rod of God is not on them. God's not punishing these guys. Now, one could make the argument that Job is exaggerating in one direction as much as Zophar did in the other direction. Zophar says the wicked are always punished, and Job is saying they're never punished. I think that the answer is we don't need to emphasize one or the other. The answer is that both happened. God does punish the wicked in this life, and sometimes the wicked get away with murder and injustice in this life also. Now, verse 11, the they is ambiguous. They send forth their little ones like the flock. That could be the wicked. Send forth their little ones like the flock, and the children, the wicked's children, skip about. Or it could be the flock itself sends their little ones out, referring the they to verse 10, his ox and his cow. His ox mates, his cow calves. They, the ox and the cow, send forth their little ones like the flock. And there, the ox and the calves, children skip about. Or it's the wicked's children skip about. Either way, the wicked is happy and prosperous. They're not being punished. We go to Job 21, verses 12 through 16. We're in the middle of a sentence here, so I need to go back to verse 11. Their children skip about, and I'm going to assume it's the wicked's children are skipping about. Verse 12, singing to the tambourine and lyre and rejoicing at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity and go down to Sheol in peace. That's the they there is referring back to the evil people. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. We don't want to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what will we gain by pleading with him? But their prosperity is not of their own doing. The counsel of the wicked is far from me. Now, I took verse 12 as referring to the singing of the children who are playing the tambourine, rejoicing. Our father is a wicked, mean old guy, but doesn't matter. We're still being blessed. And then in verse 13, the wicked spend their days in prosperity, go down to Sheol in peace. That means they're not sent to death with lingering sickness or pain like Job was suffering. They're not murdered. The NASB has they suddenly go down, which means it's not a long, dragged-out process. Not a lingering death. They just suddenly happily go to die. But they do this, even though in verse 14, they say to God, leave us alone. We don't want to know your ways. We don't want to have anything to do with you, which is the nasty, stupid attitude of about 2/3 of the American public right now. Verse 15, Job says, who is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what will be gained by pleading with him? In other words, we can plead with the Almighty all we want to judge these wicked people. That's his business, not us. He's not going to listen to me when I ask that God wreak some judgment on these stinking, corrupt politicians who are ruining the American government. I wish he would, but I don't have a right to ask for that. He can let them prosper if he so desires, if he has a plan to let them prosper for his ultimate plan and his ultimate glory. Verse 16, Job says, there, meaning the wicked's prosperity, is not of their own doing. Now, this is what that means according to the NIV Study Bible, Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. God is in control of the prosperity of the wicked, not the wicked. So when it says their prosperity is not of their own doing, it doesn't mean we cannot say that wicked people make themselves prosper. God allows it because God is God. So that raises the question, why is God allowing the unrighteous to prosper? Now, Job adds a phrase here at the end of verse 16, which is kind of interesting. He says, the counsel of the wicked is far from me. What is he doing here? Job says that to show that he is not in sympathy with the prosperity of the wicked. He is merely stating the fact of the wicked's prosperity. He is not advocating that the wicked prosper. I'm sure he was anticipating such a charge from his three wonderful friends who are going to say, oh, there, see there, Job, you want the wicked to prosper. And he's saying, nope, I don't have a thing to do with the wicked, but I'm telling you, they don't suffer like they deserve. Their prosperity is not of their own doing because God allows them to be prosperous. We go now to Job 21, verses 17 through 21. Job continues, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out? That's a rhetorical question. He wants either never or not often as an answer. How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? Does disaster come on them? No. Does God apportion destruction in his anger? No. Are they like straw before the wind, like chaff a storm sweeps away? No. Bad things don't happen to bad people, Job says. Verse 19, God reserves a person's punishment for his children. Let God repay the person himself so that he may know it. Now, what Job is saying there is he's anticipating a defense from Zophar. Zophar would say, well, maybe the unrighteous man doesn't get punished in his life, but his children get punished, so that's the same thing. And Job said, no, that's not good enough. It's not good enough to say that he's punished only in his children. Let God repay the person himself so he may know the punishment for what he's done. Verse 20, Job continues with that thought. Let his own eyes, let the wicked man's own eyes see his demise. See his, the wicked man's demise. Let him drink from the Almighty's wrath, not his children. Verse 21, for what does the wicked man care about his family once he is dead, when the number of his months has run out? In other words, just saying that the man's family is going to be punished is not punishment for the individual. Because the individual's not going to care about his family because he's going to be dead. Verse 17, Job says, how often is the lamp of the wicked put out? A lamp is probably a symbol of the man's natural life. And Job is saying, how often are wicked people killed? Not often. Could be the light of conscience in the wicked man's soul. How often is the lamp of the man's evil man's conscience put out? I don't really know what that means. The light or the lamp could stand for the man's outward prosperity and happiness. I just think it's easier to say the lamp of the wicked is the life of the wicked. How often are wicked people deprived of their lives? Does disaster come upon them? Now, of course, Job is talking about temporal disaster, not eternal disaster. Yes, eternal disaster comes on people who die and go to hell and reject God and refuse to have anything to do with him. But that's not what Job's talking about. He's talking about in this life, too many people sitting fat and happy in their castles, making money while they oppress the poor and ignore God. Does God apportion destruction in his anger? In other words, does God judge these people in his anger? No. Rhetorical question. Are they like straw before the wind? In other words, they should be blown around just like chaff in a storm. They should be scattered, judged. Does that happen? No. Job is actually repeating his own words. Same idea in Job 13:25, when Job says this, will you cause a driven leaf to tremble? Or will you pursue the dry chaff? And of course, the answer is no. God's not pursuing the dry chaff of the wicked because wickedness is not punished in this life the way we would like to see it done. We go now to Job 21, verses 22 through 26. Job continues, can anyone teach God knowledge? Can anyone judge the Most High? And of course, those are rhetorical questions expecting a no for an answer. Can anyone teach God knowledge? No. Can anyone judge the Most High? No. I'm using the God's Word translation here. Verse 23, one person dies in his prime and feels altogether happy and contented. His stomach is full of milk and his bones are strong and healthy. Another person, never having tasted happiness, dies with a bitter soul. Together they lie down in the dust and worms cover them. Now what Job is saying here is it doesn't matter whether you live a righteous or unrighteous life, you're all going to die. Everybody's going to die. And if you think about it, this is a profound statement because as we say down here in the South, some people have a tough road to hoe, and there's no explaining it. Their life is just hard. They're born into a hard family. They have a terrible family life growing up, or just things happen to them. They're unlucky, quote-unquote unlucky, and some of these people get hard and bitter, and some of these people turn into devout Christians. You just don't know. Well, in 22, Job says, can anyone judge the Most High? Can anyone teach God knowledge? In other words, this, we can't complain to God about how he administers justice in this world is what he's saying. Job is not blaming God. He's just pointing out that sometimes God doesn't judge evil when he could. But he's not blaming God for that. He's just stating it as a matter of fact. Can anyone teach God knowledge? John Gill says, quote, will anyone be so bold and audacious as to pretend to direct and instruct God whom he shall afflict? And whom not, whom God shall afflict, and whom God shall not afflict, and when he shall do it, and in what manner? No, that's God's business. We can't tell God that he should judge this evil politician or this evil person. Can anyone judge the Most High? That's God's word translation. Holman Christian Bible has, can anyone judge those on high? NASB has the same thing. If it's, can anyone judge those on high, then that would be, can anyone judge the angels in heaven? Or perhaps, can anyone judge the big shot rulers on earth? I think God's word translation is better, though, here. Can anyone judge the Most High? Because it fits in with the first part of the verse. Can anyone teach God knowledge? Can't judge God. He's going to judge. He's going to bless who he's going to bless. He's going to not judge who he's going to not judge. It's all up to him. Now, Job in verse 23 says, one person dies in his prime and feels altogether happy and contented. And he doesn't deserve it because he's probably wicked. Verse 24, his stomach is full of milk. That's problematic as far as its translation goes. KJV says that his breasts are filled with fat. The NIV translates it as his body is well nourished. But the NIV note says the meaning of the Hebrew word is uncertain. The NASB says his sides are filled with fat. Love handles. The point is, he's had a happy life. He doesn't deserve it. His bones are strong and healthy. But then on the other hand, in verse 25, you got another person never having tasted happiness. Nothing's ever gone right with him. He dies with a bitter soul. Does he deserve that? Together they lie down in the dust and worms cover them. Doesn't matter. Righteous or unrighteous, the end is the same. Worms in the grave. So Job is saying that one state has absolutely nothing to do with the person's righteousness or his wickedness. In this life, death is the great equalizer. So don't go around telling me how I'm sinning, and that's why I'm suffering all this calamity so far. We go now to Job 21, verses 27 through 30. Job says this, I know your thoughts very well. He's talking to Zophar and company. I know your thoughts very well, the schemes you would wrong me with. I didn't check to see whether that you was plural or not. I'm assuming he's talking to all three of them now. For you say, where now is the nobleman's house? And where are the tents the wicked live in? In other words, you keep telling me the nobleman's house is torn down because he got punished. The tents of the wicked are gone because they got punished. Verse 29, have you never consulted those who travel the roads? Job says, don't you accept their reports? Indeed, the evil man is spared from the day of disaster, rescued from the day of wrath. Job is saying, don't tell me that the evil get punished. All you have to do is listen to people who talk on the roads, who have knowledge of the outside world. They will tell you that there's a lot of evil people out there oppressing people and enjoying their wealth, rescued from the day of wrath. Job in verse 27 says, I know your thoughts very well, the schemes you would wrong me with. He knows what the false friends are up to. He's not being taken by surprise by their slings and arrows. He knows very well what they're trying to do. They're trying to accuse him of being a sinner and trying to ruin his reputation. He knows that they're making false charges against his righteousness. In verse 28, he says, for you say, where now is the nobleman's house? Zophar actually said something very similar to that in the last chapter, chapter 20, verse 7. The wicked man perishes forever like his refuse. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? Where now is the nobleman's house? Job is quoting Zophar, and Zophar actually said, well, where is he? He's punished. His house is gone. No, that's not true. Verse 30 says, Job says, indeed, the evil man is spared from the day of disaster, which, of course, is his case that he's been trying to make all along. Now, the NASB has, he is reserved for the day of disaster, which is exactly the opposite of what Job is trying to say here, which illustrates a point that I should have made a long time ago. If you want to understand the book of Job, do not, I repeat, do not use the King James Version and do not use the New American Standard Bible, because you will be so confused, you will be sorry you ever started studying the book. Now, at verse 30, Job says that The evil man is spared from the day of disaster, rescued from the day of wrath. The easiest thing to do is take the day of disaster. The day of wrath is the same day. In other words, the day when everything goes wrong and the wicked man is destroyed. It could be the final judgment. At least the day of wrath could be the final judgment. Indeed, the evil man is spared from the day of disaster. And so now he's ready for the day of wrath, the day of final judgment. But then he doesn't get judged then either. That doesn't make sense. Let's just say, I mean, it makes a little bit of sense, but let's just say that the evil man is spared from the day of calamity in his own personal life. We go now to Job 21, verses 31 through 34, and we will be finished with this chapter. Job says this, "Who will confront him, the evil man, with his actions, and who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. Moreover, all men will follow after him, while countless ones go before him. How then would you vainly comfort me, for your answers remain full of falsehood?" In other words, don't tell me that the wicked are judged. You know they're not. And look at these examples I'm going to give you. Nobody confronts the evil man for what he's done during his life. Instead, he has a great funeral. He's carried to his grave, men keeping watch over the tomb at the funeral. The clods of the valley will gently cover him. They have the grave-turning ceremony, turn over the clods of the dirt, and they lower the coffin. I'm using Western terminology here because I don't know how they did funerals back then, but you get the idea. You lay the coffin down into the ground, and everybody sings, "Just as I am," or "Amazing Grace," and all men follow after him, despite the fact that the guy is a wretched, low-down thug. How many funerals you've been to, and you know what the guy's doing? It's amazing what people will do after you die. I was just talking to somebody a couple months ago, and he was talking about his father. And he was going on and on about what a great man he was. Well, he was from my hometown, my friend, and I knew the guy's father, and I knew that he had shacked up with every woman in town. His wife had divorced him for that. I had another friend who told me that there used to be a little shack out there in the woods where he would take women out there all the time and have his way with them. Oh, but boy, when it comes time to honor his memory, whoa, he's the most godly and the most wonderful person in the world. That's how it is. That's how human beings do. And Job is quite rightly pointing this out. You might say Job is a little bit cynical. Well, you know what? Cynical people have a right to be cynical. When you look at the human race and what human beings do, don't blame anybody for being cynical. Job continues on with this idyllic picture of the wicked man's funeral. All men will follow after him in verse 33. Countless ones go before him. He has so many people at his funeral. And of course, the honor that the wicked are shown at their death proves Job's case that the wicked are often not punished, which is the theme of this chapter. And so Job finishes up saying, "Hey, you are vainly comforting me, Zophar and friends. Your answers remain full of falsehood." Job is not yielding to his false friends one inch. He's telling them that they are full of it, full of falsehood. Job's a man after my own heart. I like this guy. And he's doing this from a position of extreme weakness and pain, too. Let me read you Clark's conclusion about chapter 21. Quote, "This chapter may be called Job's triumph over the insinuated calumnies and specious but false doctrines of his opponents. The irritability of his temper no longer appears. From the time he got that glorious discovery of his Redeemer and the joyous hope of an eternal inheritance, in Job 19:25, I know that my Redeemer lives, since that time we find no more murmurings nor unsanctified complainings. He is now full master of himself and reasons conclusively because he reasons coolly. Impassioned transports no longer carry him away. His mind is serene, his heart fixed, his hope steady, and his faith strong. Zophar the Naamathite is now in his presence as an infant in the grip of a mighty giant." Ladies and gentlemen, with those passionate and eloquent words of Adam Clark, we are now finished with Job chapter 21. And so in our next audio, we will turn to Job chapter 22, verses 1 through 30, and we will see Eliphaz taking up the argument again. He answers Job and he says, "Job, your wickedness is great." They're not going to let him go. And so I hope you stay tuned to hear Eliphaz bloviate some in the next chapter, and I hope you enjoyed this chapter.